Okay. Today is Monday, February 23rd. I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And we're going to be hearing one bill today, House Bill 2564. And I believe that will be introduced by Representative Buckley in the place of Representative Williamson, the chief sponsor.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Peter Buckley. I represent South Jackson County in the legislature. And yes, I am pinch hitting for Representative Williamson, who was not able to attend today, but asked me to read a statement concerning the bill. So,
and before I do, I'm sorry.
Oh, you're going to have the administrator?
I'm going to have my administrator read a summary.
Why not? That sounds great.
It's a long one. It's not so long. I know.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2564 repeals statute that prohibits local governments from imposing conditions that would affect price of residential housing or direct purchase by a particular group. There's no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact. No statement issued yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill concerns inclusionary zoning, which is an issue that I've been involved with on and off since 2007. I thought maybe if I get my name off the bill this time, I'd have a better chance of passing. 48 other states have inclusionary zoning as part of their tools on affordable housing, and this would just simply allow Oregon cities to also have that tool in planning affordable housing. So with your permission, Madam Chair, I'm going to read the statement from Representative Williamson. Local leaders in my district are searching for solutions. Let me see if I started the right page. No, let me start on the first page here. Dear Chair, thank you for hearing House Bill 2564 today. As you all know, this is not the first time we've had this conversation in the Oregon legislature. I'm honored to join with many of my current and former colleagues who have worked so hard over several years to lift the statewide ban on inclusionary zoning. While there are many important and persuasive arguments to do away with this preemption, for me it comes down to one simple issue: local control. Local municipalities understand best their local housing needs. They are the ones who are most equipped to evaluate the use of a particular policy in their search for effective and innovative solutions to the housing concerns in their communities. In my district, her district, House District 36, we are facing a persistent housing crisis. While homelessness across the country has decreased over the last 10 years, Multnomah County still has as many people sleeping on our streets and in our shelters as we did in 2007. Local leaders in my district are searching for solutions, and they are not alone. Today, you will hear from local elected officials across the state that are struggling with their own unique housing concerns. But make no mistake, inclusionary zoning is not a silver bullet for Portland or any other city in Oregon. It will not solve all the housing issues in my district or yours. It will simply be another tool in the toolbox of municipalities as they address this complex and multifaceted issue. Again, colleagues, while I'm supportive of inclusionary zoning when appropriate for a community, I'm not here to argue the merits of this policy. These are conversations which should take place on a local level within a local context. It is critical that we give our communities the opportunity to consider all the policy options appropriate to meet their specific needs. It's time that Oregon joins 48 other states across the country that allow for local control on this important issue. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Are there any questions for our colleague? No?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I know we have another legislator in the audience. Were you able to stay and answer any kind of technical questions toward the end?
I am.
Because you haven't officially signed up, so I know you have some technical expertise. Okay, great. So we're going to start with our elected officials. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy days. Commissioner Deborah Cafori, Commissioner Greg Malinowski, and Commissioner Dan Saltzman.
Hi. Good to see you.
Would you like to start?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Cafori, and I'm the chair of Multnomah County. I'm very happy to be here today to support House Bill 2564, which will give local communities the ability to create housing opportunities for all types of households through the use of inclusionary zoning in our land use planning. Despite an unprecedented boom in multifamily housing development, Multnomah County is facing a critical shortage of affordable housing. Rising rents and a lack of affordable units has meant that low-income households, including a disproportionate number of families of color, have moved to East Portland and East Multnomah County to find housing. Without the ability to encourage mixed-income housing in all neighborhoods, Low-income families are too often forced to live in areas with poor access to transportation, employment, parks, and grocery stores. As chair of a county government that provides services for the elderly, disabled, and low-income families, I hear on a daily basis how difficult it is to find housing for our clients. Aging and disability staff can't move clients out of nursing homes because they can't find affordable, accessible units. Our county staff who work with developmentally disabled residents have had to place people in Columbia County because they couldn't find affordable housing, even with rental assistance in Multnomah County. Multnomah County has joined with the cities of Portland and Gresham, with Home Forward, the Housing Authority, and with Meyer Memorial Trust to create a shared governance plan to address homelessness in our community. We are aligning our policies and our resources to achieve the best outcomes for the most vulnerable people in our county. However, the biggest obstacle we face is a lack of affordable housing for low-income families. Public subsidies and voluntary incentives alone cannot overcome the shortage. We need the private sector to partner in our community efforts to develop solutions to the affordable housing crisis, and not just in Multnomah County, but all over the state. Inclusionary zoning is a practical, flexible tool that has been used in urban, suburban, and rural communities around the country. The time has come for the Oregon legislature to allow Oregon communities the ability to craft local solutions through all available planning tools, including inclusionary zoning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Greg Malinowski. I'm the county commissioner from District 2 in Washington County, speaking at this point only for myself and for my district. We have a tremendous amount of growth in our area. And one of the last areas that was added was North Bethany, which is 4,200 homes. It's supposed to be a model community with housing for all kinds of folks. When Metro had it inserted in the urban growth boundary, because it was farmland, they guaranteed that, in fact, that would be the case. They would watch it. They were a signatory, and so was Thousand Friends, so was City of Beaverton, and then the county inherited that when Beaverton noticed on the map that their city didn't actually abut it on two separate occasions. So we've got it now, and we had to put in that 20% rule and make it effective. And our staff presented us with a document that says Metro will sign off on this. This will make sure that 20% of those 4,200 homes are for workforce housing. If you're wondering, that's like $20 an hour and down, 2022. And they were saying that Metro had agreed to sign off on it, and we could throw it on a shelf and never look at it again. So of the 4,200 homes, about 1,800 homes are now on the drawing boards to some extent. There's even a full few bulldozers pushing dirt. Of that 1,800, exactly zero have been applied for as workforce affordable housing. There is going to be some multifamily rentals there, and that will probably be more affordable than the $500,000 to $600,000 homes that are making up the bulk of the rest of it. Every day, hundreds of workers who come to the assisted living center, and they come to the stores and the shops there, and at Bethany Town Center, and they come to the hospital. There's a lot of medical and doctor's programs and things like that there, and they come there to work. And then, of course, at the end of the day, if you've ever seen that movie called The Help, then they have to skedaddle to other places. One of my constituents checked in with the folks working at one of the local restaurants in there. Three different bus people that were there, and two of them commute about 30 minutes from Aloha, which apparently is where we keep the affordable housing because it's 50 years old by and large. And then one of them was commuting from East Portland. That's a heck of a long way if you're on that end of the economic food chain to come for a job. I did try and meet with one of the local developers in North Bethany to see what we could work out in the form of not only workforce housing, But I believe that if we were building a few thousand square foot units, and not cheaply made, just, you know, put in 20 feet of granite counter instead of 200, it would work for families that had were empty nesters. They wouldn't have to, like, leave the whole neighborhood in order to find a place that's on one level and it has a laundry room, a bedroom, and a kitchen all on one level. And that would also provide starter homes on the other end. And if 20% of those were there, I don't think we'd have near the problem. So I met with this developer, and the discussion was interesting because I had to agree with him three times. I came in and said, so what can we do in this community to get some workforce housing? So the teachers and the deputies who patrol it and those folks can live in the same community where they work. And the first comment they had was, you know, there's a law that says we don't have to do that. And I said, I know there's a law that says we don't have to do that. But I'm wondering if we could see if we could scooch some in somewhere in order to make it available for people who actually work in that community to live in the community. And I was told again, you don't understand. I belong to an organization, and that organization had a law passed that means I don't have to do that. And I said, yes, I get that. What I'm saying is, what can we do for you that would enable you to go ahead and provide that workforce housing for us? And a third time, he explained to me that there was a law out there that said he didn't have to do it. And so we talked for a while, and he told me if he could think of something, he would get back to me. It's been 3 years. So here's the deal. This is another tool. I don't believe if you allow it that every jurisdiction is going to apply it everywhere. But I think if I'd had that tool when I went to talk with him, we may have been able to find some way he could build something that would work for affordable housing, workforce housing, and something that would work for him. Not interested in telling developers how to do their jobs, but we give them a permission to build 4,200 homes, we ought to be able to, you know, say, hey, some of those ought to be affordable. And so that's what I'm asking you today, is to give us another tool. And it's up to you guys, because really, I haven't had another conversation about affordable housing with the developer, because I don't want to go through that three times. I got to explain to him, I know he doesn't have to do it. I think it would be good for the community. And frankly, that turned out to be a waste of my time, and that's what I learned from that. So if you all could see your way, I believe if overall we had 20% affordable housing in our neighborhoods, we wouldn't have the squinch we're talking about. Now, I hadn't heard there was room for poor folks in Columbia County, and I appreciate that, and I'll pass that on in Washington County, too, because we don't know what to do with them either. But we're supposedly one of the richest counties in the state, and we ought to be able to do a little better than exporting people to a different county. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. I'm Portland City Commissioner Dan Saltzman, and I really appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today on behalf of the City of Portland, of which I am currently the Housing Commissioner, but also joining my colleagues from Washington County and Multnomah County. And I would also add, I serve on the board of the League of Oregon Cities, and they are also supporting this legislation to lift the preemption to allow inclusionary zoning. And I think, as my colleagues have said, there's no magic solution. I can't tell you what inclusionary zoning looks like, because it looks like a lot of different things in a lot of different places. And what we're asking for is the ability, as a local jurisdiction, to have the ability to use this as one of our tools to increase the supply of affordable housing. And one thing I've learned in my perhaps 2.5 years of being the housing commissioner in Portland is that we can bring a variety of incentives and resources to bear. In fact, we have spent, in the last 10 years, we have spent close to $300 million of direct spending to create some 2,800 units of affordable housing. We provide waivers for system development charges. We target all of our federal money to go to increasing the supply of affordable housing. And we're working on incentives to provide developers additional height or additional density in return for creating more affordable housing. But we do need, and those are all sort of the carrot approaches. We do need the stick if we're really going to be serious. I have watched the largest multifamily boom in Portland history occur literally in the last 2.5 years that I've been the housing commissioner. And, you know, I'm sad to say that the market share of affordable units is really quite distressing. It's not keeping up with the need. And we need this tool, along with our incentives that we're working on, along with our direct federal resources and our direct general fund and our urban renewal funds, in order to increase the supply of affordable housing, to stop the situation of people not being able to live close to where they work, to live in the areas and neighborhoods that they choose to live in, near family, places of worship, wherever. But we are becoming increasingly a segregated society. There's no way to put it, but I think my colleagues have articulated it well. We need to provide communities where people from all walks of life can live together, learn from one another, and prosper together. And this is really what this is all about. I mean, you'll hear that this is rent control. Nothing could be further from the truth. This is not rent control. This is using an authority or getting your permission to use an authority that we use every day in city government, and that's a zoning authority. I mean, we zone for where parks go. We zone for where environmental protections go. We zone about landscaping. We zone about maximum heights. This is asking for the opportunity to have one other zoning designation, and that is an affordable housing designation. And as I said, this is something that we think is an important tool that local governments have if we're truly serious about creating more affordable housing for people from all walks of life in this state. And I think that's what we're about, and I think that's what you're about, too. So I ask for your support for this legislation, and thank you for the opportunity. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, commissioners and chair. I really appreciate your testimony. With the one here with the most white hair on top of my head, I can say that my family actually moved out of Vanport just a few days before it flooded. And I grew up in southeast, northeast Portland, graduated from Jefferson High School in 1959. So, you know, I'm personally quite aware of the segregation, literally, that went on in Portland with the African-American community and other communities of color. I also remember, maybe it was 20 years ago, a study that was done, and it was a national study that indicated that as gentrification was starting in a lot of inner cities, like Portland, that poor people, low-income people, were moving out to the suburbs, which is what we can see certainly out in Washington County. Recently, I also attended a conference, and a demographer from Portland State gave a report, and I found it interesting that with gentrification in Portland, our African-American community is moving to Columbia County. The middle-class blacks are moving to Columbia County. Poor, lower-income African-Americans are moving to East County. And I just thought that was interesting. So you're getting a split in terms of the income levels and demographics there. You're getting this moving out of low-income folks out of this inner city. So to rectify that, I mean, low-income folks consume and are good for business no matter where they're at as well as wealthy folks. So I think that anything we can do, or at least I can do, to sort of advocate on behalf of affordable housing is just critical, and I'm certainly there. So thank you very much for your testimonies.
Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Heath.
I apologize, I don't have the bill number in front of me, but recently, thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer.
564.
No, I have this one in front of me, but recently, which was enacted through the short session, so I'm not quite as familiar with it because I wasn't here, matching funds of 20% to promote low-income housing, and we're being told that program has been wildly successful. How does that, how do you see that as being successful? And follow up to this question or to this proposal, 2564, there's not much detail to it. So There's just a couple of words there. How would you see the rollout of this affecting current landowners? Is this just going to be on, to start with, properties owned either by the county or the city, or is it going to be kind of a domain issue of putting the requirements on current ownership? How is that going to work?
Well, Representative Hayden, I'll take my stab at it. I think that this is a, first of all, the 20% matching funds, you know, we'll take it. It's more than welcome, and the need, as I was saying a minute ago, is great. And there needs to be a mixing and matching of resources and incentives in order to achieve a greater supply of affordable housing. But the inclusionary zoning, or lifting the preemption, would apply, I mean, it would apply to city and county-owned properties, but it applies to new development going forward, you know. Some point of passage of a law or lifting the preemption would then allow us to each go through our own public processes of adopting laws and ordinances. But clearly, and so it's, I can't tell you when it would happen, but at least it would give us the permission to have that discussion. And yes, it would apply to, you know, private development, new development.
Follow up.
Yep.
So across the state, we might have 36 or maybe even more different interpretations of that regulation?
I think it's possible. I think as Representative Buckley mentioned, there's some 48 states that have some form of inclusionary zoning. So I think you can probably find 48 different approaches. I certainly know that Chicago has a different approach than San Francisco or New York. So I think, yeah, it's allowing that local discussion, where we often feel that those of us in local office are best suited to help tailor a solution that makes most sense for our residents, our developers, and everybody else who has an interest in that issue.
Yeah, I meant more county by county, or is it going to be municipality by municipality?
I think lifting the preemption probably creates the possibility of, you know, I doubt the county would overlap with the city ordinance, but it's possible it could. Certainly in some counties of the state, there's, you know, the county government is a larger presence than the cities that are in that county. So I think it all depends where you're talking about.
Okay. Representative, I would say it'd be more like any rule we have, like for, you know, dog licensing or anything else. It would be up to each entity. Certainly Washington County is not going to tell Beaverton or Hillsborough what to do. It would merely be a tool for them if they thought they needed it, just like it would be a tool for us if thought we needed it. I look at it, I'm on a farm. I was raised on a farm. I'm still working out there. If we cut all the trees down, part of the agreement in selling those trees in Oregon is that I replant them or come up with another use for the land. If I dig a big pit to do gravel mining, I have to fill it in or do something with it afterward other than leave it open. This is just a case of saying, hey, if you're going to build 1,000 homes, how about 20% of them are affordable? And I, having worked in manufacturing and some other industries, you know, $20 an hour is not low income. It's what a lot of people who work hourly make. And so if you exclude everyone who provides a service for less than $20 an hour from a community, who's going to do that work? And you end up having to build asphalt from Columbia County, say, all the way to where the work is needed to be done. This won't be a panacea. The place will not be overrun by minimum wage workers. That's not who we're necessarily going after. Washington County doesn't have the funds for us to go ahead and cover every fifth house and subsidize it. And I'm not sure that's the taxpayer's job. I think it's up to the developer. You have a inclusionary zoning, and you say, you know what, the best way you can figure out to accomplish this is fine. Believe me, I don't like to see rules and regulations. I just don't want to see the need for them along with a subsidy occur because we waited until people had to drive 50 miles to get to work.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a question?
Yeah. Well, so
nearly a lifelong Oregonian, been here, was born and raised here the bulk of my life, and have been actually very disheartened by what I've seen in Portland. I've lived in Portland. I've gone to Portland public schools. And some of the gentrification things that I have seen over the years, housing that was once very affordable, and particularly for low-income and minority communities, no longer affordable. I don't think inclusionary zoning would have solved that issue. Certainly, and one of the, you know, mentioned 48 states do this, and I've had the pleasure of traveling a bunch of those states. And interestingly, how inclusionary zoning plays out in a city like Baltimore is we're going to stuff all of the poor folks into one section of town. I'm curious how you, you know, are going to respond to where you look at land availability for new construction. We've seen some of the data that shows that Multnomah County specifically is all multifamily units. It's not necessarily a lot of room for individual houses. And what I'm seeing in Oregon, really disheartening, one of the states that doesn't have inclusionary zoning is Texas. Texas has a lot of affordable housing. I've got siblings who've left Oregon because Oregon is so expensive due to our land use and other things that they've said, okay, we're going to go buy homes in Texas where you actually can still buy an actual home and affordable housing isn't being stuffed in a high-rise building in Portland. So I'm sort of curious, how do you envision this actually coming forward, and particularly when there's not a lot of single, you know, unit inventory within the city of Portland specifically, but even looking more broadly at Multnomah County, when houses that, you know, used to be $35,000, $40,000 in Portland, a friend of mine showed me a listing that he listed and posted it on Facebook the other day, as expensive as any house in West Lynn with no square footage to speak of, no yard. Inclusionary zoning doesn't solve that issue. So I'm curious, you know, how do you really see that this is a tool playing out when Portland and Multnomah County specifically has so many other problems around housing that seem to not be being addressed? Yeah, whoever.
I'll just give you my perspective, and I think that's a really great perspective because we know, and thank you, Chair Kinnegar, Representative Parrish, this is not going to solve all, we're not going to, if this, then hopefully it will pass. We know that tomorrow there's not going to be affordable housing for everyone who needs it. What this will do is just allow us one more small tool that even if it helps, you know, a few residents in our community, will make a huge difference because in those the lives of those families. And one of the things that sticks out for me, and you're right, there's not a bunch of land available for a lot of multifamily or
single
family like there was in Washington County. But with the multifamily units, we know that, I mean, I've heard anywhere between 12 and 20,000 units online in the last 2 years. Either they're in construction or they're on the books. And the amount of those units that are affordable to not just the lowest of our low-wage earners but middle-income families is simply just not enough. It's close to zero. They're all market rate. They're going to come online, and most people that live in our community aren't going to be able to afford them. If we have a tool like this, we could save a few for people who need it.
And I would just add, I mean, I think you may know Governing Magazine just recently said Portland is the fastest gentrifying city mm-hmm. in the country. And what the situation you exactly described when you were growing up here, and housing was very affordable. Now we are pushing people out of their neighborhoods where they've historically worshipped, grown up, gone to school. And we have an influx of people coming to our state, and many of them are taking up what used to be affordable housing stock. So I think, as Chair Kefauver said, we're looking for an additional tool. This will not be the solution, but it certainly brings us one more tool that we can bring to bear. And certainly in Portland, it's not going to be as much, as you said, as you noted, single-family residential, but it will be multifamily. And there are still, you know, there are still opportunities for single-family residential development in the city. It's just certainly not compared to a Clackamas County or Washington County. It's not in the same, or Texas.
My other concern, and particularly, you know, I mean, I went to Vestal on 82nd Avenue. I was there for fourth grade. We lived on 78th and Stark. And when I see neighborhoods suddenly getting fancy names and a sort of a facelift as part of that, getting ready to move people out of communities I grew up in, very disconcerting to me to see that. You know, my other big concern about what I see happening, and particularly in Portland, that I don't think this tool addresses, is sort of this, moving of low-income families into zip codes in Portland where the schools are poor performing, where there is a critical lack of access to health care, where there is a lack of access to food and sort of food deserts. And if you map out some of the places we're saying, hey, we could put builders here and do this affordable housing, is actually, you know, lack of transportation. I mean, there's a whole slew of other things that goes into this, and I'm just still trying to wrap my head. Even I've sat on the housing committee for the last, you know, year and some change, still struggling to wrap my head around how this is the tool that solves those problems. And I know you say it's a tool, but when I look at where you could theoretically build in Portland, and I know those neighborhoods really, really well, I'm not seeing where some of this housing is going to get built, where we're not just stuffing people into pockets of the city where they don't have access to services and better education and, you know, streets. I mean, I drove through a street in southeast Portland the other day in a neighborhood I used to live in, and I was shocked at the condition. Certainly can't imagine having to be a family who's walking or trying to ride a bike through conditions like that. So I'm just still trying to wrap my head around how you really see this being rolled out as a tool that's going to solve and address housing when it seems like that's where housing's going in Portland.
Well, I think if you look at some of the, you know, the hottest areas of development in the city, in the inner city, if you take Southeast Division or, you know, the Hawthorne neighborhood, Woodstock neighborhood, these are all areas that are going to, that are experiencing enormous booms in multifamily construction, but they're not experiencing a boom in affordable units. So that's really our challenge. We can bring some affordability. We can purchase it through direct resources of our general fund or our urban renewal dollars. But we need something else to help us in order to get everybody at the table to share in this collective goal we have of increasing the stock of affordable housing. So it's not going to solve every problem, but it's an important tool, and it's an important way, I think, of sharing the responsibility to increase the supply of affordable housing.
And can I just follow up? Because I should have been more clear in my question. So let's say that this tool is available to you, and I used to live out on 139th and Division, grew up and spent time out there, so we kind of lived all over Portland, and was, like I said, out on 82nd off Division the other day for a meeting, and was really shocked at the sort of the infrastructure and the crumbling infrastructure in Portland. You know, so if it's great to say we want to take advantage of these sort of booming areas, but I'm not seeing the work that the city of Portland needs to do to have the infrastructure that goes with those areas so that there is transportation, better access to schools, better access to food, better access to health care, which to me, as someone who has grown up poor and struggled with housing is an issue, is really missing from this conversation. And what I continue to sort of hear is, well, we just want, you know, to sort of sock it to builders and have them, not from you all today, but in a lot of the conversations I've had with folks is, well, you know, builders need to do their part. And that's great, but I also don't think, even with the systems development charges and things you're going to charge to people, that that deals with sort of the secondary infrastructure issues that goes with this conversation. So I guess I'm still sort of waiting to see that plan. You might not have an answer for it today, but it is definitely sort of top of mind consideration for me on this type of legislation when I see those needs going unmet in a community that I grew up in. It's very sad to see.
Yeah, I mean, I take your points, and it's probably no secret to you, the city of Portland's been engaged in a conversation about infrastructure funding, particularly around transportation, and we're hopeful the state will come up with a package that will help. But your points about, you know, we need to keep up with our other needs of livability are well taken.
Thank you.
Yes, I appreciate Representative Parrish plugging for my district. The places you just mentioned are in my district, and I agree with infrastructure needs. I think the point is that the local control allows each individual municipality to say, where are the problems? Because if we have huge boom in inner Portland, for instance, on Division, to be able to craft an ordinance that says 20% of every new multi-unit dwelling goes to affordable housing means you're not pushing everyone out and you keep the schools diversified. I know that there are many people in the audience that want to address that, so I think we should probably move on, and thank you so much
for
your testimony. We have another group of elected officials, Mayor Biff Traber from City of Corvallis, Barb Campbell from Deschutes County, I'm not sure if it's an elected or not, and Mark Gamba, City of Milwaukee. Deschutes County came more than 100 miles, I think.
I don't know who's where.
100 miles. No, I don't think so. Thank you for coming all this way.
Is there a particular order you'd like to hear us?
Nope, it's up to you.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and
committee members. Thank you very much for hearing me this afternoon. I'm a city councilor in Milwaukee, and I will be representing solely myself at this moment because this has not come before us yet to so that I could say that the entire council was behind it. I do believe they would be, or at least the majority. As you may or may not know, there's a train about to arrive in Milwaukee, and with it, a lot of developers. We have one of the hottest real estate markets in the metro region at this time.
Did you state your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Mark Gamba, Milwaukee City Councilor. Sorry. Trying to get it all straight. Currently, the population in Milwaukee is, or at least the school-age population in Milwaukee, is roughly 70% low income. So as the development comes to town and we start seeing the condos and the apartment buildings, what's going to get built are things that the people that live in the city can't afford. The only opportunity we're going to have, unless we happen to own that piece of real estate, to cause those developers to include at least a small portion of that apartment building or condo at a price that most of our citizens could potentially afford, is something like inclusionary zoning. Otherwise, what will happen is there will be a migration again, as you've seen and discussed in Portland. Market rate housing is an interesting phrase to me. Currently, probably less than 70%, I mean, probably 70% of the people in the entire metro region wouldn't be able to afford market rate housing. So I don't know what market rate means exactly, but it's certainly not the working people. It's not people making $20 an hour or $25 an hour, let alone the people making low income, like $8 an hour, $9 an hour. We have to have a tool. Think of it as home rule, right? If the cities can't control what happens in their cities, what chance do we have? And this is a tool that 48 states in this country have. And we're not allowed. So as a city, I can't say, developer, you must build housing that the people who currently live in this city can afford at least a small portion of your development. So I think it's a critical thing that this pass and that we be able to move forward, because we are literally writing our zoning, our new zoning codes, around the transit-oriented development. And I can't currently cause them to build any low-income housing in that. Thank you for your time.
So, and I'm Biff Traber, mayor of the city of Corvallis, and I'm actually here representing the city council, who has had a chance to vote on this and unanimously urges your support of House Bill 2564. I have actually a letter which I understand you would have preferred electronically, and I like the electronic way of delivering things as well, so I apologize. After I'm done here, we'll see if we can get it up before the gavel at the end of this hearing. But let me paraphrase the letter a little bit. I wanted to just summarize, tell you a little bit about why we're looking for this. You've heard some of these themes already in terms of local home rule and the like, but a little bit of background. Housing affordability for lower-income workers, that has been a priority of the city for many years now, and we've worked directly with it. We've worked with local nonprofits like Willamette Neighborhood Housing and Habitat for Humanity. Resources have been constrained in what we could do in the way of building subsidized and making available low-income housing, whether it's refurbishment or building. The need continues. In the 90s, the city actually did start looking at inclusionary zoning, and then came along the legislation that took away that option. I came onto the city council and started looking at, all right, what do other cities around Oregon do for affordable housing and trying to get this developed? Because I perceive we had a problem. And that's where I learned, I was very surprised, that Oregon didn't have inclusionary zoning. Not being a lifelong Oregonian, but having lived in a number of different parts of the country, just all the discussions and the political discussions, my assumption was that was a tool here, and I began to realize nobody else was using it, so that was why we didn't use it as a city. More recently, the city council has become more concerned about what's going on with housing and where the people who work in Corvallis actually live, and looking at numbers in terms of commuter rates and the like, were for our numbers, perhaps not huge for some of the cities you already heard from, but 18,000 people commute into the city. That's over half of the employees in the city who work in the city actually commute into the city. And for a city that would rather have people live near where they work, that is not a good statistic. So we commissioned Echo Northwest to go tell us more about what was happening. And affordability was the issue with housing. 40% of those who commuted would like to live in the city and couldn't afford to. And as we actually also asked them, educate us about policy choices we might have. There were a whole number of low to moderate impact policy choices, many of which we already did. One of the more impactful ones they said you don't have, which is inclusionary zoning. Don't have the ability to do this, to be able to help move along more affordable housing in town. So we're sitting here looking at situations where so many people move. We have situations like 30% of our school teachers in the local school district aren't able to afford to live in the city. We have the school superintendent last week at a State of the City panel session. Question came up, and she jumped right in and said, this is a problem that they perceive. We would like you to pass this legislation so that we'd have the option to use this tool in a way that fit how we want to use it. I can't tell you what it's going to look like. We've not actually tried to develop what the zoning would look like, what the other what else we would do there. I can guarantee you, being Corvallis, this would be a long and open and vocal conversation with the community as a whole. As a counselor and now as a mayor, I live with that as a positive asset when you're trying to figure out what makes sense here in terms of where this goes. So I'm not going to dictate a solution. Our city council will hear from the citizens and we'll work through that if we had the tool. We don't have the tool, and so we struggle with little steps. So I thank you for the time this afternoon, and I thank you for having the elected officials up early, since I do have to get back for a council meeting this early evening. And I urge you to pass this legislation.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you so much. My name is Barb Campbell. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm from Bend, Oregon, and I was recently elected to the Bend City Council. And Bend is experiencing a terrible crisis of affordable housing. We have, of our citizens that are making 80% or less of the median income, more than half of them are rent stressed now. More than half of them are paying more than 30% of their incomes, which means in Bend, approximately one in five people are rent stressed, which obviously means they're financially insecure. They're in an unstable position. And we have that same situation of folks just commuting. They're living in Redmond or Prineville or Lapine, and they're driving to Bend in order to work. We have no available, close to no available housing. Our rental market, we've dropped down to 0.3% availability on rental market, which any given day means if you come to Bend and you're hoping to find a place to live, there might be 10 units for you to look at. So in Bend, we're looking to make changes as huge as numbers like five. If we could get five houses or apartment units built, that would be a big difference for us. We're really looking for any kind of help. We've tried adjusting. We're working right this minute to change our cottage codes and our code for accessory dwelling units. We're adding density bonuses and trying for breaks with our system development development charges are some of those other tools that we're talking, you know, that we're trying to use to attack this problem. And this is just, again, overusing that metaphor, another tool that we'd like to have available to us. I really feel confident in recommending that you pass this. It's simply repealing a ban. There's no requirement for anyone to do anything. Any community that cares to can take up this tool and shape it the way they want. And Representative Parrish, I understand Portland is a whole lot different than Bend right now, and it's really, the only answer I have for you is I don't know if it's going to help you at all. And, you know, that's the truth, except maybe with a brand new multifamily unit where you could require that some of the units are affordable. But in Bend, I really do. I think this has the opportunity to help us out a lot. And again, I like that idea of the local control. We can sculpt it the way we want. One of the remarkable things about it is you can define what affordable means. In Bend, we have one community, for example, that has created an affordable cottage zone within the development. Those affordable cottages run maybe $400,000. I know. There's the woman from Bend, right? But you know, to me, that's where the flexibility of this is really a great thing. You can say that affordable means a percentage of the neighboring houses. It has to do with the development itself. And you can say that within that development, we want to have some units that are more affordable than the $800,000 homes that are just a couple of blocks away. I really do. I think this could help us. I think this could help us with our workforce housing. I think this could help us with housing that most of us do think of as affordable for those folks that really are making a living in our community. So thanks again for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yep. Mayor, you mentioned a study that Eco Northwest had done. Is it possible? Did you submit that as testimony? Or could we
get No, but I can get it. I did not submit it, but I can get it sent to you.
Thank you. I would certainly appreciate a copy of it. I mean, of course, you said mentioned it had IZ as one issue, but I'd be curious to see what some of those other issues. You know, I have to look at somewhere like Bend, somewhere like Westland, where I live, you know, where a small tract of land is the land price alone, whether you're going to get somebody to build something affordable on top of it, it really puts a lot of this housing way outside of the reach of affordability. When, you know, I could take the same small quarter acre tract in West Lynn and buy, you know, 25 acres in another state where they don't have some of the pressures on the land use system that are really part of driving up the cost of housing. So I'd be curious to see what they came up with on, particularly on the land use in your area. And I've got to step out real quick.
Any other questions? Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I just want to make another point. I'm also on the higher ed committee, and we're very concerned about 40-40-20 there throughout the state. But, you know, I just want to remind this committee also that housing is a critical element in terms of school success and stable housing. And that's what we're really talking about here, is making affordable housing more available to folks and giving people a fair shot at getting ahead and getting opportunities. So, again, I just want to again point that out to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam, I'm sorry. I'm not sure if I mentioned. I'm only speaking for myself today. I also I'm a new counselor, and our new council hasn't taken up the discussion. So okay. Make that clear.
Great. Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair. I always think before trying to solve a problem, you need to clearly know why you have a problem. So do you know or have an idea what's causing our housing in Oregon to be so unaffordable for so many people?
When you ask the question for Oregon as a whole, I'm assuming this is coming through since they don't hear me. But anyway, when you ask the question about Oregon as a whole, no, I don't know.
Okay, how about your community?
And in our community, part of it is land cost, part of it is development cost, part of it is what the market will drive. And we don't have a tool to help direct the market, which is, in my mind, one of the key things with having an inclusionary zoning, however that looks when we finally have that tool. One of the dynamics we have in Corvallis is you, Representative Guy Gallegos talked about higher education, the higher education part of that, the growth of Oregon State University has brought a lot of new students and faculty into town, which has driven, we didn't get as low as the Bend rental vacancy rate, but we did get down below single digits, down below one for a period, and we're coming out of that. And that caused a lot of conversion of single-family homes into investments into rentals for students, and that caused... So there's a number of causes that are floating around in Corvallis that we need to deal with. And
do you think the high system development charges, do you think the lack of buildable land, do you think the falling per capita income could be contributing to the lack of affordability of housing in the state of Oregon or even your community?
Some of that is true when you're talking about our the city of Corvallis, and we're trying to get a new handle on the buildable lands inventory, and some of the other recommendations from Echo Northwest included how to develop more buildable land so that we could actually deal with that appropriately.
Thank you.
If I might answer as well for our own community, you're absolutely right. Those are all huge factors in whether or not we have affordable housing. But in Bend, for example, we tried to expand our UGB a few years ago, and it was kicked back to us. So we're in the middle of a UGB remand, which means we're really behind in the amount of available land. We've got, I hear from good reliable sources that it's going to be at least 3 years before we have any new buildable land in our community. And so, again, we're looking for any kind of tools that might help us in the meantime, you know, an assortment of things that might give us a hand with that.
Okay. Good. Follow up? So do you think this committee or others should be working on trying to fine-tune that UGB process so it doesn't take over a decade to expand our...
I don't think so. I think they just try. I mean, I wasn't on the council at the time, so it's very easy for me to say that they just didn't do the job right. I will tell you, I moved to Oregon from Colorado, and Colorado is similar to Texas in the sprawl. And I think our UGB and land use regulations are part of what makes our state so special and makes so many people want to move here, which drives up the price of land, you know, as much as, you know, so I don't want those. No, sir. Thank you.
Representative Kenny Geyer, or Chair Kenny Geyer, and Representative Buehler, I would say that I agree that part of the cause is the influx of people to this state, and they're coming here not because there's spectacular jobs to be had, but because there is, because we've made a lot of wise decisions as a state, and I think our urban growth management is one of those. I think people move here from Atlanta because they don't want to, you know, commute for 3.5 hours. I think we've made a lot of wise decisions. I do, however, think that you were right. You hit the nail on the head with the low income. I think, and that's not just Oregon, that's the entire country. There's, you know, a great disparity between the lowest income and the highest, and somehow that bottom end has got to move up and carry the middle with it, because what we're seeing is year after year, more and more people can't afford sort of the American dream of the single family home, the car, blah, blah. Right. And, you know, you can literally track it from my father's age when a man with a decent job could buy a house and have a car and his wife could stay home and raise kids. And you think about what the lifestyles have changed throughout the decades. And now two people, I have friends, one's a school teacher and one's a young lawyer, a beginning lawyer. They can't qualify for a home loan.
Follow up, please. Well, I think we, you know, it's a careful balance here. All of us don't want to see our communities become an Aspen where only the very wealthy can afford to live there, nor do we want it to become a Boise where we have endless sprawl. But as I travel around the state and go to Portland and other cities and see the growing number of homelessness on the streets, I think the balance is tipping the wrong direction.
Well, we do. Representative Ken Helm is a land use lawyer, and I've asked him to tune in. Maybe he's outside for now. I don't see him here. But I think he can answer some of those, may be able to answer some of those questions, too. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Good luck with your meeting tonight.
Yes, thank you very much.
I will now call up, let's see, Justin Wood, John Chandler, and Sean Jillians.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and fellow representatives. My name is Justin Wood. I am a home builder. My company name is Fish Construction. I'm actually here with two hats in addition to working for Fish Construction and being an owner. I also work for the Portland Metropolitan Home Builders Association. At Fish Construction, we build typically about 15 to 20 homes a year, and mostly in Portland, mostly single-family infill. And at least half of the homes we sell every year, we're able to sell to families making at or below median family income. We're able to do this without a government mandate in the city of Portland using programs like SDC waivers and tax abatement districts. Alone, SDCs on a single-family house in the city of Portland can run over $20,000. In other areas, like North Bethany, where Commissioner Malinowski mentioned earlier, they can approach $30,000 to $40,000 for one single-family new house. SDC waivers are a very good tool that allow us to discount that. Some of the things that we personally have always liked about these two programs is that it doesn't necessarily create, as Representative Parrish mentioned earlier, areas where the housing goes specifically. We can build one house next to somebody who is at below median family income, and then the next house won't be, and so you really can't even tell in the neighborhood what houses are sold to families at a below median family income. In addition to these programs that we've done voluntarily with the City of Portland, we've also explored more partnerships with organizations like Proud Ground and Habitat for Humanity. We recently sold two houses just last year to Proud Ground, where they were able to put a family in making below 80% of MFI, where they were able to make up that gap in funding. We've also built four houses for Habitat for Humanity in the last couple of years as well. Where in addition, we're talking to the City of Portland and their Housing Bureau as to ways that the city can help provide resources and remove roadblocks so that we can do more public-private partnerships like this. In my second hat working for the Home Builders Association, I've been able to see, and I've just been working for the Home Builders Association doing government affairs now for the past 3 to 4 years, I've been able to see direct impacts that a lot of our land use policies and systems have in place. I apologize that I did not bring a larger chart, and I'd be happy to share it with anybody that would like to see it. But I do have a chart from Metro that outlines in 20 years the percentage of our single family capacity which will be used in the Portland metropolitan area. And essentially all of our single-family capacity in Portland will be used within the next 20 years. And due to that, our housing prices will have gone up at least twice, and in many cases, three times what they are currently. So while I understand the need for our land supply system, and I do think that there is a balance, I think we're out of balance. I think the fact that you're seeing the housing prices go up so much is a good example as to what the policies and choices that we've made have had a direct effect. When you couple that with the SDC prices, you can really start to see how things can get expensive fast. Additionally, I was asked last year, I believe by Speaker Kotek and serving with Representative Parrish and Representative Reardon to serve on a work group here at the Capitol to tackle the issue. And we had a very diverse group of people in the room, and we came out of that work group with a long list of ideas to present forth for this session to consider. I'm saddened to see that this bill has come back only because inclusionary zoning was not one of the things that came out of our work group as something that we should try that we're not doing. And to see that we've defaulted back to this short of trying some of the other alternatives is unfortunate for those of us who invested our time in that work group. There are many tools that the state, the counties, and cities can do to help create affordable housing. Several people, I think, consider inclusionary zoning to be the silver bullet, but unfortunately, there are examples of jurisdictions across the country where inclusionary zoning does not work. Unfortunately, it's my fear that if inclusionary zoning is available in the toolbox, that many jurisdictions will default to that as their automatic option for ways to create affordable housing. In the case earlier, as mentioned earlier, of the North Bethany example in Washington County, since that has been in the news lately, I don't believe there were any other specific tools tried like SDC waivers or various other things. In the case of North Bethany, there were examples of density bonuses, but when you're in the Portland metro area and you're already building to such high densities, getting to go from, you know, 13 to 14 units an acre up to 15 units an acre isn't really a bonus. In a lot of cases, that would be seen as a negative to go more dense in a super dense area like that. So I do think that the cities and counties have the resources available to try to make this situation better. Some came out of our work group. I think if they want to try to tackle the problem, they should try to use all the tools in the toolbox that they have now before we get rid of the ones we do have. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Appreciate your time today to talk about the goals of this bill, which is obviously providing more affordable housing in all of our communities throughout the state, which the Oregon Association of Realtors obviously supports and agrees with. Unfortunately, though, the method to get there with mandatory inclusionary zoning is not something that we're supportive of at this time. Housing affordability obviously has a substantial impact on the real estate industry. As more people are priced out, that's obviously a direct impact on our members, and it's not something that we want to see. And to that effect, we've supported previous efforts here in the legislature to try and tackle the issue, not only participating in the work group that was mentioned. In 2009, we supported a document recording fee increase to go to affordable housing projects, one, to retain existing affordable housing units, and two, to actually provide down payment assistance for purchasing for folks who are trying to get into home ownership. We also have looked at changes to our land use system. We participated in a work group for many years with the former chair of LCDC, where we were looking to see if we could achieve some lowering of the land cost in exchange for some affordable housing. Unfortunately, the result of that was the legislation didn't pass here due to some opposition, but we have, in good faith, tried to go forward. I think you've heard a lot about the 48 other states that have this tool. The one thing that I would say is those 48 other states don't have Oregon's land use system. We're one of a kind. We are the only ones who have the top-down control of how our land use system is delegated to locals. I think that's sort of a source of frustration for us. We would definitely agree that more local control is a good thing. Unfortunately, by and large, our land use system doesn't operate that way. So it's difficult. And the main reason that, as the real estate industry, we have a problem with mandatory inclusionary zoning, you guys have heard a lot about market rate sales prices, is if developers are forced to put in additional affordable units, that ultimately drives up the cost of the market rate units that are out there as well. And especially at the scale that we deal with in Oregon, the last time I testified on this bill, which was 2 years ago, I gave a little bit of history of when I lobbied in southern Nevada during the boom years when Nevada was growing like crazy, and I represented the city of Henderson, which at the time was the fastest growing city in the U.S. And we had a voluntary inclusionary zoning plan where we would give density bonuses to developers. The scale of units that we were looking at is developers would come in with a 13,000 unit development that they wanted to do. Master plan community, and we'd bump it up to 15 or 16,000 units in exchange for a number of affordable housing units being integrated into it. Obviously, my colleagues to my right don't have that luxury of doing 13,000 unit master plan communities in Oregon. Our land use system doesn't afford that. The one other thing that I would mention before I take any questions, if you all have them, you've heard a lot, and at the risk of opening up yet another bill or an amendment, you've heard a lot about rental units and affordable rental units. I would look just to make sure at ORS 197309, which is what this would repeal, and it says policies that would have the effect of establishing the sales price for a housing unit, the sales price. What we're really talking about in this particular preemption is establishing a sales price for people who are purchasing units or homes. And so I think while I understand the frustration of folks around affordable rentals, we're not convinced that actually lifting this preemption would have any impact on that whatsoever. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Chandler to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I apologize. We're having server issues at my office, so my testimony was unable to make the electronic sequencing from my office computer to you, Commissioner Johnson, but we'll get, or Administrator Johnson, we'll get that to you soon. Listening to this testimony is bringing back a flood of memories, not all of them pleasant. And as I have to tell you, Madam Chair and members, I'm deeply, deeply frustrated. This issue, you've heard from the commissioners and others about rental housing and homelessness and low income. Absolutely agree there's a crisis out there. This bill doesn't do anything about that. The issue of affordable housing in the state has been a problem for a long time. I don't believe this bill is going to address it. And as Mr. Gillian and has indicated, we've been participating. The real estate industry has been participating over the last couple of decades in ways to make housing more affordable in this state. There is no ban on inclusionary zoning, stickers notwithstanding. There is a ban on mandatory inclusionary zoning. And since these terms aren't defined, that makes it pretty easy to swap back and forth between rental housing, for sale housing, what we're talking about. Inclusionary zoning, generally speaking, is where a sales price is set for a house or a condo. That a certain number of units, some percentage, 20%, 5%, numeric, it doesn't matter, is set for resale. Jurisdictions can do voluntary inclusionary zoning now. The only point of the statute that this would repeal is that they can't do it mandatorily, and if you really want to look at what that means is they can't make it our problem to fix. A mandatory inclusionary zoning system. Right now, they can offer incentives, they can offer bonuses, they can offer fee waivers, they can offer time waivers. You've heard about the tools in the toolbox, and you almost get the impression that's all that's left in the toolbox is some electrician's tape and a rusty screwdriver. That's nonsense. There are lots of tools available in Oregon. This doesn't affect their availability. All this bill would do that's in front of you is make it the builder's problem to fix even a sliver of the affordable housing problem in this state. And I got to tell you, Madam Chair and members, that's beyond aggravating for us. We didn't cause the problem. People who build houses, people who purchase new houses, do not bear a unique responsibility for affordable housing in the state. I reject that. We are part of this system, you bet. We would love to build more affordable housing, absolutely. Commissioner Malinowski mentioned Bethany. He didn't mention the land in Bethany went for $500,000 an acre. Lots in Bethany are $150,000 an acre. Impact fees, permits, SDC, system development charges, are almost $50,000 an acre. We're going to be $200,000 into a piece of dirt before we put a stick down, and somehow, magically, poof, we're supposed to develop affordable housing out there. It can't be done. We need a serious conversation. This is a frustration, Madam Chair, and I beg your indulgence. I apologize. We have needed a serious conversation in the state for the 25 years I've been playing in this sandbox about affordable housing. And we come up every single time right to the edge. We look over and apparently say, ouch, that looks hard. That looks difficult. Let's not do it. We need to talk about land use. We need to talk about environmental regulations. We need to talk a better way to fund infrastructure. Measure 5 passed and cut off cities at the neck. They can't raise enough money through the local property tax, so they defaulted to impact fees. We understand that. We wrote the bill that gave them the authority to do impact fees. We work with them on a regular basis developing impact fees. $50,000 a house impact fees is probably a legitimate number. I'm not complaining about it. I will tell you that it's very difficult to do affordable housing when you're doing an infrastructure development, water, sewer, streets, one at a house at a time, one subdivision at a time, one condo project at a time. We need to have that serious conversation to figure out ways to bring down land prices, lower the cost of development, figure out ways to raise wages in this state. All of those pieces are all of what this is talking about. You cannot, I don't believe, single out one industry and say, tell you what, why don't you figure out a way to make this work? We don't do that, as far as I can tell, for any other field of endeavor. We don't take a broad social obligation, be it medicine, housing, education, and tell the people involved in it, because it's really important, we think you should bear an, you could take less money. You should sell at a loss. You should provide your services cheaper than you would otherwise to help us with this big, important issue. It is a big, important issue. It deserves a more serious, thoughtful, rational, comprehensive, difficult, politically tendentious, and perhaps expensive approach than simply a one-line bill that says repeal the statute and all of a sudden things. Even a sliver goes away. It's still not right. It isn't our fault. We want to be part of the solution. If this bill goes forward as written, we're going to fight it tooth and nail. We can't not. We would be more than happy to work with you and the members of this committee and the members of the advocates sitting behind me and coming up with a plan. I don't know what to do about rental housing. This statute and this bill only deals with for sale housing. But more than happy to come up with ideas that might move this ball forward and actually get serious about it once and for all, whether it be more money for the housing agency, whether it be direct subsidies to builders who are willing to hit these targets. Maybe it's a new tool for financing. There could be a number of things. I will simply point out, as I believe Representative Gallegos mentioned, I absolutely agree with you, Representative, the importance of a safe, secure home and a safe, secure neighborhood on children's performance. And back not that many years ago, this legislature used to run well into July and August making sure we had money for schools. We've never, ever once done that for housing. And we collectively, your predecessors, all of us in this room are complicit in the lack of attention to housing. If we were serious about it, we'd be having a much different conversation. I'm here to pledge my support for that serious conversation, Madam Chair and members. I'm also here to pledge my absolute opposition to this bill, because I don't think it does anything, and I believe it singles out an industry unfairly. With that, I will hop off the soapbox. Be glad to take any questions you might have.
Thank you. I see the Speaker of the House is here. If you can hold off, we'll see if there are any questions here. Okay, I'm sure we'll be in touch. Thank you so much for testifying. Speaker Kotek.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity for the record.
Welcome.
Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. Colleagues, you should have my testimony online in OLIS. There's also a link there on my testimony and, that says click here on the PDF. It should work. If it doesn't, let us know. But it's a link to some information about housing affordability in the state that you can check by location. So for your individual districts or counties, you'll be able to find that information. I'm here to support House Bill 2564 today. It's a really simple change in law. I am very encouraged by the panel that just left, talking about the importance of affordable housing, talking about how we should do more in the state. When I became Speaker in 2013, I created a portfolio for this committee, Human Services and Housing. Housing has, and I think I agree with Mr. Chandler, has been a little left out of the statewide conversation. There are people in this building very serious about the affordable housing conversation, and this isn't the only discussion to have in that vein. But this is a really simple bill. This is a bill that says local government should have another tool to figure out how to meet the housing needs of their community. Many cities and counties are working really hard to try to figure that out, and you'll see when you link on that information that, you know, there are a lot of folks really struggling. Even though there are efforts at the local level, stagnant incomes and the rising cost of living have made it very hard for people to afford their housing. Between 2007 and 2011, a quarter, 25% of Oregonians were extremely rent burdened and paid more than half of their income on housing related costs. The state is watching. We are watching. This is an important issue. This is a multifaceted problem. There's not one answer to the issue. However, this bill is saying, let's give other options to local government to deal with it. Because even though the state is involved, housing issues are solved at the local level. And maybe that'll change one day, but right now, it's local government that's trying to meet the housing needs of their communities, and this is a tool that will enable them to do that. You know, back in 1999, when this preemption was approved, there was a lot of debate on the role of government in trying to solve the problem of affordable housing. Folks who testified in support of the preemption said that government could not solve the problem. I also don't think developers and home builders can solve the problem. It's not an either-or conversation. It's a private and public partnership that has to happen. And all this bill does is pushing that conversation back to the local level, where it rests right now, and gives another option for local governments to work with developers and the home builders to try to solve this problem while we also work on other things. So I hope we'll support this bill. It's a really clear bill. I'm looking forward to local governments taking this issue up a lot more strongly. I agree with Mr. Chandler that we need to all work together and prioritize this issue. That does not mean we shouldn't do this bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Madam Speaker, are there any questions for her?
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, we will continue with our panel then. We've got Sasha Haswald, Felisa Higgins, and Diane Lynn. We have 10 people left in about 40 minutes, so if there's any way you can try to keep it to 4 minutes, knowing that we'll also probably want a few questions.
Good afternoon. Thank you, committee members. Thank you, Chair Kaney Geyer. It's great to be here in Oregon. I'm visiting, and my name is Sasha Haswald. I work with the Cornerstone Partnership. We are a nonprofit intermediary. It is our mission to support excellent housing policy and programs that create long-term affordability and community stability. And I oversee Cornerstone's inclusionary housing team. So what you're talking about today is very exciting to me, and it's going to be a challenge for me to keep my statement to under 4 minutes.
Where are you based?
We're a national organization with offices in the D.C. area and in Oakland.
Okay. Well, you can have a little more than 4 minutes if you came all this way.
Thank you.
Sorry, you didn't make them more than 100 miles, so I didn't
realize. So what we do is we work with jurisdictions all over the country to help them figure out whether inclusionary is the right tool for them and how they can tailor inclusionary policies to suit the specific needs and local conditions in their community. We do that not only by working with the city staff and with the electeds, but also with developers. We interview developers, we have developer focus groups, and we ensure that their voice is also heard in the crafting of inclusionary housing policy. So I came here independently to share our hands-on experience with making that kind of policy and to share a national perspective on the issue as you consider lifting this ban on inclusionary housing policy for the state of Oregon. I'm here to also share some examples from our experience that highlight the wide variety of inclusionary programs currently in use, and I hope to also address some of the common misunderstandings about inclusionary, which I think is where I'm going to start, because I heard a couple of misunderstandings spoken here today. And I wanted to tackle a couple of them before I move on. I wanted to tackle the question of whether or not the cost of inclusionary housing gets passed along to the market rate renters and owners. This is a misunderstanding that comes up sometimes. And there's another thing that I heard said, which is that the cost of inclusionary housing is borne solely by the developer. That also is not true. And in fact, it would be impossible for it to be true that the renters and the owners are bearing the full cost and the developer is bearing the full cost. But what's actually true is the developers are price takers in a market where most of the housing is already built. That means that they cannot increase their prices arbitrarily just because they're facing some slightly higher development costs. And rather than doing that, they need to get creative about the way that they make it work for their bottom line. That often means that they negotiate for land a little bit differently. And what we see in the long run is that the cost of inclusionary zoning is borne by a combination of landowners and developers. And it eventually can even bring down the price of land in places with incredibly rapidly rising land prices, which is a concern I heard voiced here today. The other thing I heard is that, you know, why not just keep it voluntary? There's a lot of tools that you can use, and that's absolutely true. And mandatory programs do make use of the cost offsets and incentives that were discussed today. But in fact, 85% of the programs nationwide are mandatory, and there's a reason for that. It's because they're far more effective at bringing developers to the table who might not be so generously inclined. I think at this point I will pause and see, should we go through everybody here before we take questions? Or
you know, if you're willing to pause right now, we have Senator Knope just came in.
Yes.
I know he's going back and forth between hearings. If he could be squeezed in here and then we will get back to this panel, that would be great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for coming.
Senator Tim Knope, Senate District 27, representing Bend, Redmond, Sun River, and Tumalo. In my other life, I have been the Executive Vice President of the Central Oregon Builders Association for, I'm going to my 12th year now, and I also work for a nonprofit that does affordable housing. And I also serve on a board of a nonprofit that does single-family affordable housing as well. So we've dealt a lot with the issues surrounding affordable housing. In the community of Bend, we have virtually no housing available, period, affordable or not, because of Oregon's land use issues. And the number one thing that you could do is ease the burden as it relates to expanding UGBs, and that is the reason that we have affordable housing issues in Bend. Affordable housing, which we've done much, I think we've done about 30 single-family units in the last 4 years through our nonprofit. And one of the things we've found is that it makes, quite frankly, more sense to provide incentives and to work collaboratively with developers. And we are essentially a affordable housing developer. We try to bring in builders who want to build. And so we've worked with the city of Bend, and we've worked through federal grants. And we actually have an affordable housing fee in Bend, which has helped us leverage that. But ultimately, the cost gets passed on to consumers who aren't buying affordable product. And inclusionary zoning, especially it being mandatory, would be a significant problem. And one of the issues is Oregon has unique land use laws that don't exist in other communities. And so what we have is, especially in Bend, is a urban growth boundary that is artificially constrained, and we don't have enough land to go around to mitigate out the cost. And so ultimately the cost gets passed on. So for instance, if you did 10 units, if you went to somebody and said, as a developer, you have 10 units and one of those is going to be affordable, I can assure you that they're not just going to say, okay, so I'm just going to eat the cost of a $75,000 lot in Bend. They're going to have to pass that on to the other 9 units. The problem is that every $1,000 increment you raise the cost of housing knocks another family out of the market that otherwise would be able to afford what's called a regular house in your community, my community, and so on. And so in the city of Bend, we've pursued several different options. One is a cottage code, which just means you can cluster smaller houses together in smaller pieces of property. We've looked at accessory dwelling units, sometimes called ADUs, sometimes called granny flats. But we've been working on a policy to try to get those implemented in the city of Bend. We've attempting to do density bonuses and encourage developers to upzone their property to provide more units, because ultimately the market is a supply and demand market, and you're never going to suspend that. You're ultimately going to have to deal with it. And so when government comes in and mandates a policy, oftentimes it just exacerbates the problem and doesn't solve the problem. You know, San Francisco has some of the most expensive real estate in the country and the West Coast, and they've had inclusionary zoning for quite some time. And so The reason that Oregon has had this policy precluded is because it's just not a good policy and it doesn't work well. And so having cities doing this piecemeal across the state ultimately isn't going to be productive for providing affordable housing in our community. So I think we should look to other potential options that are out there. And I think there are many that can be done, but I think inclusionary zoning is not one of those. It's going to be helpful or beneficial, and ultimately it's going to cause more havoc, especially in our market. So I thank you for your time and be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Any questions for the committee?
Thank you much.
Thank you for taking the time to come down. So we will return to the panel. Would you like to keep going?
Yeah,
would
that
you like
sounds,
to divide
that
up?
Great.
State your name again. State your name again for the record.
Sasha Hauswald, I'm with the Cornerstone Partnership. I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to sort of respectfully disagree, but if a developer were able to charge more for their market rate units, then why weren't they doing it before the inclusionary zoning requirement came into place? Are they just sort of generously charging less, even though the market would be able to bear a higher price? I think that sort of is the question about who pays. Is it's based on the assumption that developers aren't already asking for as much as they could possibly get on the market. In any case, I'm sure that you're aware that Montgomery County pioneered the idea of inclusionary zoning about 40 years ago, and at this point it's a time-tested policy. It's not terribly new and innovative, and there are about 500 jurisdictions across the country who have implemented it, who have not seen dramatic negative market effects. Otherwise, I'm sure we wouldn't be seeing those numbers today. In California, about 60% of the inclusionary housing programs are located in smaller cities and suburbs. So the smaller cities and suburbs with populations under 50,000 people, and about half of those are in towns with under 20,000 people. So while it's common to think about inclusionary housing policies in large urban places like San Francisco, it's in practice that a majority of the programs are in smaller cities and towns. The advantage of the tool is that it's not one size fits all, and the jurisdictions can tailor them to their precise context. The local jurisdiction can offer cost offsets, like many folks have suggested, and the cost offsets are variable from a small fee waiver, say, to a high-value exemption from height limits. And now, this kind of hits on a point that a couple of other people have made, likening inclusionary zoning as a barrier to development, just like restrictive zoning practices. And it's actually quite the opposite, that typically inclusionary zoning is paired with an incentive or a cost offset or a variance to the existing more restrictive zoning code that's in place. So, if I have time, I'm not sure how we're doing here, but I wanted to give you a couple of stories of places that have implemented inclusionary housing, Breckenridge, Colorado, and Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Maybe give one and speak really fast. I just want to make sure the other people who came here have a chance to, and then maybe we can have you stay at the end as well for anyone that would like to continue. So give one.
Okay, that sounds great.
Sorry, quickly.
You know, I'm going to pick Breckenridge because we heard a lot from people in Bend, and Breckenridge can actually be likened to Bend. It's a ski town with a large vacation community. Its demographics and its housing market look a lot like Bend, Oregon. And there are many winter-only residents with second homes and vacation rentals in Breckenridge. Another similarity to Bend, actually, is that it's an inconvenient commute for anyone who can't afford to live in town. There aren't many transportation options, and so the commute is kind of tough for the service workers and resort workers and shop owners. It sounds like a lot of folks who work in the tourist industry in Bend have to commute from Redmond. So Breckenridge did have the tool of inclusionary zoning, and they solved the problem of affordability with a combination of inclusionary housing, developer agreements, and public investments. And all told, with this layer cake of different policy contributions, Breckenridge created over 600 workforce housing units. It's a full third of their total housing stock, and it's enough units to accommodate tourist industry and service workers, allowing them to live closer to where they work. Their inclusionary program requires 10% of any new development to be set aside for moderate income renters or buyers, and that those units be mixed in with the rest of the development. So I do want to note what's kind of interesting is that developers never left Breckenridge. They could have easily shifted investment to any number of other Colorado ski towns without inclusionary programs, but they've continued to invest there. And the reason is that the town's economic vitality is actually a direct result of their inclusionary housing program. By including those workforce housing units in new developments, there remains this authentic working community feel there, or as city staffers call it, a genuine atmosphere that attracts steady interest and tourism and is allowing the local economy to thrive. And I'll leave it there. I'm happy to stay afterward and tackle some of any of the other questions that you have.
Great. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. It's really wonderful to be here. Honor to address you today as a former local elected official in Multnomah County. My name's Diane Lynn. I was a predecessor of Deborah Kafori and many others, and it's great to be back in Oregon. I've been gone for about 6 years. I'm presently the executive director of Proud Ground. It was an agency referenced earlier by one of our partners in the Portland area around one of those classic examples of how partners can come together from the private nonprofit and public sector to help really take on this problem. We did COPE for many years, and I know all of you know that local elected officials really face a series of unfunded mandates and issues that really cramp and cause challenges at the local level, and much of that is very necessary. The state really has to play a role in kind of a statewide policy level. In this case, it's simply, I'm going to go back to the basics because we're going to look to Sasha and her teammates at the Cornerstone to help us really work through the details of how this could be applied here in Oregon. But our simple message to you today is please allow the local communities to get together with the developers, with the builders, with the jurisdictions, the funders, and come up with new ways to do this work. It's critically important. I took care of people for 6 years at the homelessness level in Marin County, and now I get the great opportunity to help working families get into home ownership. It's a community land trust model that allows, with one single subsidy, a chance to hold a unit of housing in affordability and perpetuity through a shared equity model, and it's an innovative way in partnership with other agencies like Habitat for Humanity and other ways. We're not just talking about homelessness. That's part of the housing continuum that's critical, but we're also talking about allowing working families to get into homes where they can raise their children, send their kids to school, as was mentioned earlier, plant gardens, have pets, thrive at a level of income that 60% of the jobs in Oregon have been providing. 60% of median income is the level of income people are making here in Oregon. That's the jobs that have been created. Those people should have a chance to live, and in our case, we're promoting home ownership in that sense, and we're doing it in a creative way. We need, this isn't about politics, and it really isn't about positioning. It's really about allowing local communities to do the extraordinary work that I know all of you know is possible. So we're asking your support for the simple process of having the state step out of the way in this case, allow people to come together. Inclusionary zoning, as you just heard from Sasha, is a tested tool. It's used across the country. We need everything we can get here in Oregon. We already have a cobbled tax system for a thousand reasons. And we need, there isn't enough money to really provide the subsidies necessary to help working families do well. And in the cycle of poverty that we so desperately want to break, so we don't have kids falling into the cycle that their parents experienced, where kids can become a part of the community and grow up in stable and safe housing. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. And I think Representative Taylor wants to ask a question now.
Yeah, so I was actually wondering, thank you. Chair Kinzer, I'm not sure exactly how the rules work with this, but we're hearing a theme here from all sorts of folks that there's potentially that Oregon's unique in that because we have the urban growth boundary and that perhaps inclusionary zoning would be in conflict with that. And I was wondering, can we bring up Representative Helm or a different expert, somebody who can explain whether or not it can coexist here in Oregon, I appreciate the fact that we have experts here on inclusionary zoning. I guess what I think would be helpful for all of us is to understand, can inclusionary zoning work with our urban growth boundary? I appreciate your work, but I was just wondering if we could have someone else come up
I was checking to see if he could stay throughout, because I thought there may be other questions that would come up. And
okay.
He's a good technical resource for the end of this.
So my question is whether or not it can coexist legally.
You have to leave at 5. Right. Okay. And you may have responses to that, too. Yeah. Diane, thank you for coming. It's great to have you back after 6 years of housing work.
There is life after politics.
Yes. Very nice to see you.
We're all looking forward to that.
I'm still standing.
We're all looking forward to that. So, Felisa.
Ken Helmer, me? Okay. For the... Chair Kinnegayer, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins. I'm the political director of SEIU Local 49. I'm here today on behalf of SEIU Local 503 and Local 49. We have 65,000 members throughout the state of Oregon. And the vast majority of our members, over 75%, actually make less than $50,000 a year. And many more of them are in the mid-30s, mid-30s to, you know, 20s. low 20s range. And so we're here in support of House Bill 2564 because we really believe that affordable housing is such a critical issue for our folks throughout the state. We also believe that that issue has to be addressed at the local level, which has already been expressed by the local elected leaders who've spoken here today, because each community where our members live looks very, very differently. And as you all know, actually, this is a committee that's a wide representation of the state. I'll give you an example of our janitors who work in the Portland metro area. What we've been able to watch, many of them clean commercial office space in downtown Portland. We call it Class A office space. It's some of the most expensive office. It is. It's not some of. It is the most expensive office state in our state. We have been able to watch through voter registration data. Our members move out and out and out as rents get less expensive and as people then shift into a place where they can start to buy or own homes. We believe lifting the ban on inclusionary zoning for those folks would be incredibly important. They also work shifts where the public transportation doesn't match the hours that they work. Many of them go to work at 7:30 at night or later, and they get off at 6 in the morning or earlier. 7:30 to 3 is a common shift. So you can take public transit into work, but once you're downtown, you cannot get out of downtown Portland. So a lot of the folks that you will see sleeping around Class A office space or sleeping on park benches outside of the Rose Garden are actually not homeless folks. They're our members who are waiting for the buses to restart. And so we really think affordability is a critical issue. We also think the other issues that were raised today are also very important issues. This hearing is just not about those. We will be in Salem supporting many issues when it comes to increasing wages, dealing with food deserts, supporting some of the layers of housing infrastructure, transportation infrastructure. We're all in on all of these issues to address the issues that our members face when it comes to the workforce issues and their ability to have a livable life in our community. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Representative Buehler?
Yeah, thank you very much for your testimony. You make a powerful argument for local control of housing. How come you can't make a similar powerful argument for local control of land use planning?
Chair Kinnegayer, Representative Buehler, I am definitely not an expert on land use planning.
Do you see the inconsistency, though?
Is
the question directed at
any of?
So, yeah, I think Representative Ken Helm is much more of an expert than I am, and I'm sure would be happy to answer that question.
Well, I would just like to add quickly that when I mentioned earlier that there are things that the state really has to do as a matter of fairness and support for a statewide public policy position, which is the land use planning system in Oregon's established way back in the early 80s, is exactly an example of what needs to be done on a statewide basis in order for it to be consistent and fair statewide. This is a case where we need all hands on deck at the local level to work creatively to really resolve, at least use everything we've got to resolve problems. I do see a complete distinction between the land use system and allowing.
What's the distinction?
again, maybe someone else can articulate this better, but land use planning statewide has been part and parcel of the inspiration that's made Oregon really what it is today, the way our natural areas are preserved, the farmlands.
But you're saying the local communities know best for housing. Why don't they know best for their land use? There's an internal inconsistency here that
we may
have a hard time understanding.
Excuse me, Representative. We may have just a philosophical difference on what should be local. I personally think that the land use system is a critical statewide policy, and this is an example of where local jurisdictions can make a big difference.
I certainly can't speak to whether the land use controls in Oregon should be more locally controlled, but I can speak to the fact that there are jurisdictions with extremely restrictive land use regulations that are local. Most of the places where I work have local land use regulation that also have inclusionary housing policy, and it's not viewed as an additional impediment to development. So they're two separate issues.
So this will not necessarily be our last hearing on it. I hear a huge, a cry to entertain that piece of it. I do want to make sure that everyone who came has an opportunity to talk. And we're hoping to get Representative Hellman before 5 o'clock as well. Although this might be just good background for you, because if we go on in the future, you're at least in this building. So I want to really get to people. So on the next panel, we have Tim Moorfield, Carly Edwards. Is that right? Tim Moorfield, Carly Edwards, and Kathy Wai.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Wei, for the record, and I am here on behalf of APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. Just as a background, APANO is a statewide grassroots organization uniting Asians and Pacific Islanders to achieve social justice. We believe that in using our strengths, we can advance equity through empowering, organizing, and advocating with our communities. We were founded 15 years ago under the principle that we are stronger together if our communities organized around issues that impacted our health and our well-being. And we are very much interested in improving outcomes for members of our Asian and Pacific Islander community, who are now the second largest demographic group behind Latinos in Oregon. So just to demonstrate the growth, from 2000 to 2010, we have seen a 50% increase in the Asian population, and that number is more in the Pacific Islander communities that vastly make up at least 20 different island nations, from Tonga, Samoa, Micronesia, and Palau, to name a few of those groups. We have one of the largest concentrations of growth in the Portland metro area, but we know that other places in Oregon are growing as well, such as in Washington and Marion County. For example, the second most common language spoken in the Salem-Keizer School District is Marshallese from the Republic of Marshall Islands. That's compared to the first, which is Spanish. I make these points to highlight that this growing diversity that we have in Oregon and the patterns of migration will continue to make a lasting impact in our neighborhoods and in our cities. Our families have called Oregon their home for many, many generations. We build upon the roots that have been long established, and we make space at the table for new groups that are coming in. For me, I grew up in Oregon. I graduated from both high school and college in Portland. My family first moved into a tiny apartment off Southeast 39th and Powell, and then we moved off to a duplex on 82nd. And eventually, my parents purchased their first home in the David Douglas School District off 139th and Mill Street. Through my personal experience growing up in these neighborhoods, I've seen Portland rapidly changing and the cost of housing increase dramatically. Excuse me. I know that many families that used to live in these neighborhoods can no longer stay there because of the lack of housing affordability. And the decreased opportunities. This has caused many families to move further out to East Portland, where they're also very far from services and resources. So I'm here today, and also on behalf of our organization, to lift the ban on inclusionary zoning, and so that we can truly increase housing opportunity for all. We know that it is one of the key anti-displacement tools, and that it will also already serve established communities. One of the community development projects that Apano is doing is in the Jade International District. Thanks. So the Jade International District is comprised of 12 blocks of Southeast 82nd Avenue, and it is an urban renewal area that has received much public attention. Since 1990, the neighborhood around Southeast 82nd and Division has grown twice as fast as the city as a whole, and it's also becoming far poorer. The area's Asian population doubled in the area, and according to the census, which is the census tract 8301, if you want to refer to that, it is the most racially diverse place in the state of Oregon, with 53% people of color. The Harrison Park School, where 72% of the students are of color, and 85% receive free and reduced price lunch, grew so fast that the officials had to convert locker rooms there into classrooms. With community building and transportation investment, we know there comes displacement. So there's a lot of community organizing that's happening in the Jade area. We hope that inclusionary zoning would create opportunities for families to stay and truly, truly thrive in their own neighborhoods. Local communities best know their own housing needs, and inclusionary zoning can be customized to directly target and meet the needs of these residents, while we hope we can also balance the developers' interests. So we hosted a series of different Jade visioning circles last year in the 82nd Avenue with five different communities making up Vietnamese, Russian, Spanish, Russian community members. And we've heard a lot of input in terms of the projects they want to work on and happen in their neighborhood. Apano is supportive of these community members' vision, and we hope that we can get support from you to create an Oregon where our neighborhoods and our places are really valuing diversity, culture, and inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chairwoman Kenny Geyer and committee members, my name is Carly Edwards, and I'm the State Director for Oregon Working Families. Oregon Working Families supports inclusionary zoning and believes this to be a priority issue because our voters value the ability to work, live, and play in the same community. That's why this is one of only a few bills we are tracking and reporting back to our voters in this session. We support inclusionary zoning because it is a common sense solution to the growing housing problem in Oregon. Increasingly, Oregonians are being priced out of buying or renting homes and being forced to move further and further from the areas where they work and where their children attend school. The fact is, working families need both good jobs and a decent place to live. Zoning laws can help make this possible, but only when local governments have the ability to make decisions that reflect local conditions and the needs of their citizens. Without sane zoning safeguards, the market will decide. And when it comes to housing, that means the market will price working families out of the neighborhoods that allow for the kinds of essential resources that many of us take for granted, but are essential for working families to survive and thrive. These services include good schools, public transportation, jobs, and grocery stores. Our organization believes it shouldn't be a luxury to have a roof over your head, nor should it be a luxury to have a manageable connection between the place where you work, sleep, and play. Please help make this a reality for so many Oregonians who don't currently have this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Jim Moorfield. I'm Executive Director with Willamette Neighborhood Housing Services. We're a nonprofit that was born in Corvallis, but now we're serving land in Benton counties, and we have properties in multiple communities. I also have a background 37 years now living in Corvallis. Long time ago, I was on the Corvallis City Council as a citizen, as a volunteer. I've worked on multiple updates of our comprehensive plan and followed the land use planning processes in Corvallis for quite some time. And I'm a developer of housing in Corvallis, so I understand what it's like on both sides of the table when it comes to the regulatory framework in which we operate, as well as to what it takes to actually build something. And none of it's easy. I'm reminded that I've been supportive of our land use planning process because I know how important it is that we have farm and forest land that's not part of the speculative housing market in Oregon, because that's been essential to our economy and to our natural resources. I also work in a community and live in a community where we don't have a problem with the urban growth boundary. We've tried a number of tools for getting more affordability into our community through the land use process, through the code requirements and so on. We have granny flat ordinance. We have density bonuses. We have a whole variety of tools, and it hasn't been enough. We're still have a stressed housing market. We have buildable lands inventory that says we have plenty of developable land, but it still hasn't been enough. So we need to do something more. We need to use every tool that's available to us. Right now in Corvallis, we have 11,000 people, almost 5,000 households, that are paying more than half of their monthly income on housing. So when any family is spending more than half of their monthly income on housing in the first few days of the month, what's left for the rest of life's expenses, including food? That's one of the reasons why we have high rates of hunger and food insecurity in Oregon generally. But I want to talk about home ownership. Most of the housing development work we do is for serving very low-income families in multifamily rental housing. But we're also one of the 17 regional housing centers spread around Oregon that helps people learn how to buy their first home. And we've been doing a lot of foreclosure work in the last few years as well. And one of the things that I've learned over the last year or two is the relationship between household or family wealth and home ownership in the United States. In the past 30 years, the average wealth of white households and households of color has gotten greater. The gap between white families and families of color has gotten wider, not smaller. When I was a young person, I thought the world was going to be a better place than that by now, and it hasn't happened. The problem's gotten worse. Now, why is that? There was a study that came out a couple of years ago from an institute at Brandeis University that looked at a variety of factors involved in a growing racial wealth disparity in the United States. And the single strongest factor was home ownership. Unemployment, the things you would think would be other important factors, such as job, unemployment, inheritance, wealth transfer from your family and so on, were all important as well. But outscoring them all in the impact was home ownership and the disparities in the rates of home ownership and how long someone's owned a home. And so we live in a changing nation and a changing state. And this is a problem that we're going to have to address, and we have to use every tool available to us to address it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Quick question.
I think you make a great point about home ownership because, you know, that's the biggest generator of equity for families. So that's what troubles me a little bit about this concept. So help me what happens. Someone moves into an inclusionary zone. Who gains on the equity gain, the price gain?
Or
it seems like either a windfall, you either have price controls where that family doesn't gain equity, or you let the price increase over time, they build equity. So how does that work in an exclusionary zone? Follow what I mean? Because it could be an enormous windfall if you don't allow the the price to go up. But if you don't allow the price to go up, they can't gain equity like you normally would with homeownership, which is, you're right, the biggest driver of wealth.
You're asking a complex question, and the reason it's complex, or I can't answer the question right now, is because how different communities implement an inclusionary zoning ordinance may vary. And so how they do it may be different in Corvallis than in
Portland. So we start driving up the regulatory burden because those are very complex decisions that are then going to be made at various levels across the state.
Well, I think you heard some earlier testimony that we're not just talking about passing on a cost. We're talking about changing the economics of doing the work. And so
this is downstream from that.
Not necessarily.
This is 10 years.
I think the person from Cornerstones testified that it starts impacting land prices. These factors aren't just fixed factors, you know. And with all other things being equal, and then inclusionary zoning is simply an added regulatory burden or cost shift. It can be more subtle than that, and it depends on how local communities design their program. There's some communities, for instance, that create an affordable housing fund as a payment in lieu of doing something at a particular development. The ones that I'm familiar with, and I'm not an expert, typically don't impose the requirement except for subdivisions over a certain size. So the economies of scale start having an impact in a way that's different than if you were just building two homes, for instance. And so it affects some segments of the market and not others. And I would say that in terms of the windfall issue, I mean, there are ways to deal with that. Diane Lynn from Proud Ground is a much better person to talk about different models of ownership that start maintaining our investment in the supply of affordable housing while giving families a return on their investment. But you also heard testimony that we're talking about a wider range of people than just the very low-income families I house, for instance. I think we're in a place like Corvallis, we're talking about needing to intervene in some way so that people at 120% of median income can afford to live in our community. We have 17,000 people.
That's a whole different question, though. The issue is, once someone's in an inclusionary zone and they're there for 10 years, who gains on the equity, or is it price controlled?
I certainly would not in my community support a price controlled inclusionary zoning mechanism, except for a certain segment of the population that is priced out of home ownership, even with this assistance. That's where a community land trust model comes in. I wouldn't support putting long-term controls on home sales prices for people at 80 to 120% of median, even though we need to increase the supply of housing for those people.
So those people getting in the inclusionary zone then are winning the lottery compared to the poor people who don't get into the inclusionary zone.
I think it depends how it's set up, but let's let Ken come up and answer a few technical questions or say something about the land use. We've got four other people that want to testify, and if we can bring Cornerstone back to wrap up any other technical questions, I'm hoping that you all can stay till 5:15. You know, people, it's a hot issue. People came here from a long ways away. If you need to leave, then we understand. You've got other obligations.
Can I re-ask my question, Chair Kenny Geyer?
So, would you like to ask your question to Representative Helm?
Yes.
Yes,
please.
And let him, for the record, state his name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ken Helm. I represent District 34, Beaverton, Cedar Hills, and West Haven, Rock Creek. Go right ahead. The chair has asked me to attend today in case you have questions. I intended to come to be a neutral party at this public hearing in order to answer questions generally about the land use system as I understand it.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer.
And we will also have another crack at you, but if there's any burning issue right now, I just want to
So I thank you for coming and doing this for us. We all happen to know that you're a land use attorney. So I think it's very interesting that people are bringing up all these different points, and I genuinely want to understand, because Oregon has an urban growth boundary, and others is, I don't know what other states have, but if Oregon is as unique as it's, I've been told, and we're considering inclusionary zoning, I guess my question is, can the urban growth boundary and inclusionary zoning, meaning that local jurisdictions would be able to have the option of implementing that and they would come up with their own policies for that, can those two coexist here in Oregon? And if you could answer that, please, I would be ever so grateful.
The first part of the answer to that is that while we are quite advanced in our land use program, I believe, in this state, we're not the only state in the country that has an urban growth boundary or urban growth area type of concept. Just to the north, they have urban growth areas in Washington. They're not quite managed like ours are. They're not quite as rigorous, but they do have them. To directly answer your question, I don't see that the two things are incompatible in any way. What we often tend to forget, and our particularly our rural representatives are quite right to remind us of often, is that the whole state isn't like Portland. Okay, Portland has over 20 cities and counties together in its own urban area that has its own urban growth boundary, and it magnifies a lot of the issues. And growth just happens to be very high there right now, okay? Bend is another example that may be a couple of the only places in the state that has a very steeply ascending growth rate right now. The rest of the state, the growth is fairly predictable. It's some places are not growing very fast at all, some are not growing at all, and others are growing pretty much as they have in the past. And there is a mechanism for understanding the population forecasts for those communities that is now being done out of PSU. That's a fairly objective process, and they're generating numbers that help communities understand their growth for the next 20 years. Then they plan toward that. The one idea that I think it does not have a very good evidentiary basis is the flat idea that simply expanding urban growth boundaries is going to drive the price of land down and is going to drive the price of houses down necessarily. One comment that I think is borne out by the research is that housing prices are what they are, and when a home builder, a multifamily builder, goes to price their product in the market, they tend to look at other prices and come right up to it. And they should. They're in business, right? They want to have a profitable business. They want to continue.
If there are no other burning questions, let's get to the last four people.
I'm available at Unitarian.
And yes, we will probably have you back at some point. So I'm going to call up Patricia Weber, Sheila Grinlaw Fink, Stefan Herrera, and Joanne Harrigo. Squeeze up one other chair.
Okay. Chair Kenny Geyer and the rest of the committee, thank you for providing me the opportunity to testify today. So my name is Patricia Weber. I'm here on behalf of my employer, Devco Engineering Incorporated, a Corvallis-based civil engineering and land use planning company. Consulting firm. I've been employed at Devco Engineering since 2007 in the capacity of land use planner. Prior to that, I served for 5 years on the City of Corvallis Planning Commission, 3 years on the City of Corvallis Housing and Community Development Commission, and 2 years volunteering for Benton County Habitat for Humanity, doing a land use application involving an 18-unit mixed income housing development. So I have looked at affordable housing from basically every angle. I've been on the city side, I've been on the affordable housing developer side, and now I work in a capacity where I do planning applications for developers. I'm here to urge you to vote no on HB 2564. It is a piece of very well-intentioned legislation that will likely have unintended consequences that will exacerbate the problem rather than alleviating it. And the problem I refer to, of course, is affordable housing throughout the state of Oregon. In Oregon, communities with tight real estate markets, affordable housing development needs to be subsidized. As stated previously, Oregon's rigorous land use planning laws provide myriad economic and quality of life benefits to Oregonians. However, the drawback to our state land use policy is that it tends up to drive up development costs and reduce profit margins for developers. Affordable housing in Oregon is provided primarily by the nonprofit sector, which is eligible for funding from both government and philanthropic foundations. It is not realistic to expect the private sector to absorb the full cost of subsidizing affordable housing. IZ would in many cases cause a decrease in the development of housing. I'm not talking about what's fair. I'm not talking about what's right. I'm not talking about who shares the burden. I'm talking about what realistically will happen. The comments that were made about in other places in the country where inclusionary zoning has worked, Cornerstone, the representative, stated that it is paired with incentives. It is paired with subsidizing. We can't do it alone without having subsidies in place that go along with the IZ zoning. Given higher development costs and lower profit margins that are the consequence of strict state land use policies, developers will walk away from housing developments that are not financially feasible. I see this every day in my job as a land use planner in Corvallis. The choice presented to the public with inclusionary zoning in place in many markets will not be housing developments without affordable housing versus housing developments with affordable housing, but rather housing developments without affordable housing versus no development of housing at all. Reducing development of housing suppresses supply and will result in higher housing costs overall, which defeats the purpose of the legislation that this is trying to accomplish. Land use policy alone cannot solve the affordability crisis. Again, if cities are going to implement this, they also would need to couple it with subsidies and financial incentives that would make it financially feasible for developers to proceed. Otherwise, it won't happen. That can't be done through the land use planning process, so you'd have to have cities that would be coordinating their departments and their funding with their land use. And I don't know, maybe that happens in Portland, but I personally do not trust the city of Corvallis. I would hate to see inclusionary zoning in Corvallis, and I have worked, obviously, given 2 years of my life, free and clear, to try to move affordable housing forward in Corvallis, just because I know how developers will behave and I know how my city government will implement this. They'll think it's the fix, and that's all they do, and they will not provide a funding mechanism. I just want to close. Sightline Institute is a progressive environmental policy think tank based in Seattle that addresses sustainability issues in Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia, including land use issues as one of their policies. Sightline's executive director, Alan Durning, has stated, "One half of the solution to rising housing prices is to allow much more housing. The other half of the solution is to further subsidize housing efficiently for poor families." Thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. And all of this is in my written testimony and expounded on in great length.
Thank you very
much. Not too great a length.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairwoman, committee members. My name is Stephen Herrera, and I'm work for the Urban League of Portland. So in the interest of time, I'll just stick with my script. So the Urban League of Portland is asking for your support for House Bill 2564, the repeal of the ORS 197309, which would allow the use of inclusionary zoning and restore local control of land use planning in the state. The Urban League recently participated in several overflow meetings on housing issues in Northeast Portland, and the lack of affordable housing
housing was one of the most prominent issues. Our communities have been severely impacted by the adverse effects of urban renewal and gentrification. Many African American communities were priced out of their homes and out of their traditional neighborhoods. Inclusionary zoning, while not a fix-all to displacement, gives cities a critical tool to combat economic and racial segregation, gentrification, and displacement. It enables cities to ensure low-income families and communities of color are not locked out of residential developments in resource-rich areas, reducing crime and increasing neighborhood stability. As more families move to East Portland, it is clear that inclusionary zoning could help keep low-income residents in close-in neighborhoods, reducing transportation and housing costs, and leaving more money for essentials like healthy food, clothes, health care, and recreation. It could give low-income residents greater choice about living areas with good-paying jobs and schools and healthier environments. Inclusionary zoning is working in many communities across the country and has shown positive results in creating more diverse communities and generating funds for low-income housing. Only Texas and Oregon have statewide preemptions. Local jurisdictions should have the freedom to choose what tools are appropriate to improve housing stability and access in their communities. Repealing the ban in inclusionary zoning will give them an effective and affordable housing tool. We urge you for your support on House Bill 2564.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee who remain after 5 p.m., it's been a long day for you, and I won't share any of the comments I had intended to. I'll just say that, for the record, I'm Sheila Greenlaw-Fink with Community Partners for Affordable Housing. Portion of Representative Parrish's district is in our service area. From 20 years or so of working in Washington County, what I can say is that the local governments we work with care a lot about building diverse and inclusive communities, and they struggle to do that. They would never in a million years put impediments in place that they thought would slow development. And in fact, I think it would be hard to argue that in Washington County, development has been slowed. While you might argue we have many impediments, fees, permits, SDCs are much higher than they are almost anywhere else in the state. Beyond that, we have a real estate transfer tax. We've had it since the 70s. Those things, which are a cost and which certainly are a part of what makes our community sometimes unaffordable for the growing population in poverty that is being pushed into the suburbs, those impediments haven't slowed development. Private developers, as has been, has shared, will develop where the demand exists. The demand exists for $500,000 homes. We just want to say that with tools like inclusionary zoning, we can make sure that we don't build those at the expense of closing out all the service workers, the landscapers, and the many folks that people in those homes expect to see in their community. We don't want them to have to commute 45 minutes from Oregon City to Washington County. We have residents who walk at 1:30 in the morning on streets without sidewalks. The cost of sprawl is great. We have a lot of communities without the amenities we need, but we can't let the fear factor of what could happen if we repeal the ban on inclusionary zoning stop us from doing what we know we need to do in some local communities. And I strongly believe that some of the local communities in Washington County, whether at the county or at the local jurisdiction level, will decide to use this as one of the tools. We work with jurisdictions who've adopted a variety of tools, and that's what we need, a variety of tools. So we really hope that you'll take these issues into consideration and allow jurisdictions to choose this one as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our last speaker.
I think I can do it from here. My name is Joanne Harrigal, chairman and members of the committee. I work with Elders in Action in Portland, and the Elders in Action Commission is an advisory committee to the City of Portland and Multnomah County, as well as the Aging and Disability Services Department. Elders in Action also has, we enthusiastically support the passage of HB 2564, lifting the ban on inclusionary housing. We have, as part of Elders in Action, a program called the Personal Advocate Program, where we provide free, personalized problem-solving assistance to seniors over 60. We receive about 250 calls, at least 250 calls a month. And when I asked the INA people yesterday how many of those are older or are people that are seeking housing, they said at least 50%. So
What I know is that in Portland, in the Portland metropolitan area, over the next 15 years, we're expecting a doubling of the population over 65 years of age. And as that population ages, the portion of the population that is low income and seeking housing is going to also increase. So we encourage you to give us this additional tool and pass the ban on inclusionary housing. Thank you.
Okay. You have a question?
Yeah, so specifically with regard to senior housing, because I think that is a huge problem. I absolutely agree with you. I'm curious how you think this tool solves that, and particularly for seniors right now who are being priced out of their homes, particularly in a city like Portland. So I'll just share, a couple years ago I was watching the news after one of the elections. There were quite a few tax things on the ballot, and the station, I don't remember if it was COIN or KGW, sat down with a homeowning couple, young couple, and, you know, figured out what their new tax bill was going to be, and it was about $600 of net new taxes that were going to be assessed as a result of those local votes. So when I look at a senior on a fixed income, I mean, I think the real problem that I hear from seniors in the metro area is they're not being priced out because of their housing costs going up. They're being priced out because of their taxes going up, and so and not seeing their income sort of matching the growth in the tax increase. And certainly as assessed values go up, we could say whether they're artificially rising or whether they're land use based or whatever. It doesn't change the fact that assessed values continue to go up, and that plus new taxes are driving a lot of seniors from being able to afford their home. And so I'm curious, you know, for seniors who are existing, how does this, existing homes in Portland, how does this solve that problem for them?
Right. We get most of the calls that we get some from people that are seniors in homes that are being priced out because of taxes. That's true, because they have fixed incomes. We get most of the calls that we receive are from people that live in apartments, however. And in those cases, it can be the case that they've been at a specific rent for several years or, you know, minorly increasing. But with the recent economy and the real estate circumstances being what they are in the urban area, they can, landlords can just evict you for no cause, because they can renovate your apartment and give it to somebody that'll pay a higher dollar. And so people really are put out on the street. I don't know how you fix that. I think that it's the answer to the question is not to move them out into the suburbs, but rather to find affordable housing and create affordable housing where they live and where the services are, because they can't afford to commute back and forth to where the services are, and they're not out in the middle of the suburbs. So,
not
good
that there's
question.
Anything wrong with the suburbs.
No, we love the suburbs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I know we're past now 5:15. It's thank you so much for coming all the way from Washington, D.C. It's great to have a face to a name, because as we work through other questions that come up, we'll be able to at least be in touch by phone with you. So thank you so much. That, I think that's probably it. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2564 and adjourn us. Thank you.